Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Cohn.
I'm Heather Mackett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Spring from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another episode of Not the Footy Show. We enter our 21st year on air. Happy New Year to everybody. I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
And we have, as usual, a really good guest lined up for you today. We're catching up with Benita Mercedes, who wrote Whatever It Takes about the corruption surrounding the Australian World Cup bid, the Russian bid and the Qatar bid. But she now runs a publishing company where they're publishing sports books. They've now gone into fiction, and I wanted to catch up with them, find out how somebody who's been in sports administration moves into publishing, and also how it's going publishing sports books.
Oh, and you've only just released a book, haven't you?
Oh, it was last, was it last year? No, 2024.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they very kindly published my ladies first about the 1988 Seoul Olympic hockey team winning the first team gold medal for Australia
in the
Olympics
of any team sport.
Of any team sport.
Oh, I didn't know that little.
Yes, fact. And in the book I explain, because it's the how the IOC regard teams. So if you're in a cycling pairs, that's not regarded as a team.
You know, like so equestrian, is that?
Yeah, they have very specific rules about what is a team.
They got a lot of very specific rules.
Yeah, so but anyway, so those women were the first. Oh, yeah, the helmets. Yeah.
Get onto stuff like that. Well, I thought we should review what's been going on, Ashley, in the world of sport.
Cause yeah, because I've been away for January, so, yep.
Globetrotting again. You've been in India.
I was in India. It wasn't really globetrotting. It was one place.
But India Hockey League?
Yep.
Good?
I enjoyed it, yeah. I mean, it was very packed as a commentator because it was 33 games in 24 days.
Wow, okay.
But
when you add in travel there, that's...
It was very good. What was great about it this year, I think, was the fact that the tournament, we went down to the very last round-robin game and still didn't know who was going to be in the finals.
Oh, wow.
That was good. That was really good. The one thing, they tried to adopt the sort of Australian style of finals this year, where, you know, the loser of third and fourth would play the loser of first and second.
Yeah.
I think the thing that they need to look at with that, whereas I felt it was a little bit unfair, was those two teams then had to play again the next day to play the third bronze medal game or the final. And I just think, you know, that yes, the second team got through to play in the gold medal match, but they lost. And the team that lost the other game, they did actually win the bronze medal. But yeah, I just wonder whether it's fair having them having no day, rest day, whereas the other teams had had. So the team that came fourth had had like 3 days off, I think it was.
Yeah, one of is it an issue? I don't know. One of the issues I find with the way that hockey does their finals and stuff like that is we never get free air between. There's never any time to build the final up because those teams aren't decided usually until the day before. So there's no gap there to get a bit of hype going or get some publicity going or build the match up. It's just bang, bang, bang. Oh, yeah, they're the champions. Off you go.
Yeah, I mean, I've always found it strange that within the sport they have the rest day before the semifinals, then semifinals and final, as you say. Surely for your final, you'd want to give the players a rest day before they go into such a big game.
And everybody having an equal rest. And give it time to brew and get some
excitement building,
it, all those sorts
Anticipation.
Of things. Look at the Super Bowl. It's 2 weeks. And look at what they managed to do with the hype surrounding the Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I'm not asking for 2 weeks, but, you know, a day or 2 days might be nice.
Well, I mean, I'll give you an example. I work with a producing director who did the... Real Madrid versus Barcelona. You know, the big El Clasico. And they plan that for a year.
Wow.
Television wise, because they start with both teams from the minute the sun comes up right the way through till after the game is over. And that's a year's worth of planning.
Yeah.
And that just shows you how committed some of these broadcasters are to some of their sports.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, You know, no one can help when the final might not live up to expectations and the hype, because sometimes they don't. Super Bowl on Monday, and that game certainly did not live up to the hype.
Yeah, but that's often the way, because it's a final, there's so much at stake.
And very often, you know, like, you don't often see huge comebacks in finals. They might be close, you might have a close one, but you don't often see a team that's a long way ahead get beaten, because they, when you start getting behind in a final and there's no tomorrow, and I think sometimes it becomes a bridge too far for a team. They just go, oh God, that's it.
There's nothing worse than losing a final,
though. Oh yeah, and it's horrible, and especially when you know that you're going down.
Yeah, those last 15, 20 minutes feel like hours.
Yeah, that's right. And as a spectator, they feel like hours too.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not good.
So we've had a few other things. I did want to ask you your opinion of the FIFA Peace Prize.
It should never have happened.
Can I just say, I had a good giggle and laugh. I reckon Infantino had a little smug little smile on his face when he was doing that. I think they were taking the piss.
Well, yeah, I thought it was truly disgraceful, and Infantino should have been forced out of his position as the president of FIFA. We'll hear Benita's views a little bit on Mr. Okay. Infantino in the interview a little bit later. But yeah, look, I just thought it was embarrassing to the game, and I think I didn't read any fan that was supportive of it.
No. What do you think of the idea of boycotting the World Cup? Because I mean that had traction there for a while. I think that talk has quietened down somewhat. But are there real issues for fans travelling there that are going to have to face? Is it?
I think that the interesting thing that I've been reading is I just think a lot of the fans have just been priced out now. The sheer cost of the tickets. The sad thing is the average football fan simply cannot afford to go when you throw in airfares, accommodation, and then the price of tickets. Going back to your question about whether they should boycott it, it's one of those really difficult ones, because you consider how hard the players have worked to earn that qualification to go there. This World Cup, I feel it's not quite as special because we've got so many teams participating, and there are teams there that would normally never make it to a World Cup. So I think they've diluted the kudos or the special feeling of qualifying for a World Cup, because now we've got every man and his dog can qualify. So I don't like that. I think it needs to be a really special event where, you know, the best teams in the world are competing. I also, when I look back, because I'm an old man now, but there were times where you could watch every game in a World Cup.
Yep, yep.
You can't now. There's just not enough hours in a day if you've got a job to be able to catch up and watch all the games. And so, yeah, I'm not a fan of that. But boycotting it, it's a tough one. I think you'd have to have very strong convictions at the moment for the behaviour of the United States. Anything can happen still in the next couple of months.
Yeah, I'd be keeping all of my
options open.
No, if I was travelling to the World Cup, I'd make sure I had all the right paperwork on me at all times. But that might not even help you if you get caught in the wrong spot. Do you reckon they'll bus crowds? I mean, can you honestly, is the American public going to fill the stadiums when it's a game, you know, two low-ranked teams?
Yeah, I don't think they will.
From poor countries.
No, I don't think they will. But I don't think they'll fill the stadium, but whether they bus in crowds, like you say, I don't know.
I mean, we've seen it happen before in a lot of countries. It's not as if it does. It usually involves school children.
Yeah. I was going to say maybe they could have those that they're holding that they believe are illegal refugees. Let them have a little bit of...
Well, that thought was, we'll bus them in from the ICE detention centre and send them back up.
Yeah, but that's probably in poor taste that we're even thinking that.
Yeah, it is in poor taste.
But it's the sort of mad thing that America would do at the moment.
Well, it seems that way. But, you know, it's in Canada as well.
And Mexico.
So we shouldn't forget that. It's not just an American event. It's across two other nations as well.
But they're, I think, just keeping quiet and going to go, look, we're going to put on the best show we can when we host games here, and you're all welcome.
Yeah, yeah. We'll see how that turns out. I think the football will still be good. I don't think.
You would expect it to be, yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's still a World Cup at stake.
No, I'm just wondering. Because we've talked about, you know, the whole Ukraine-Russia thing in pre, well, I think it must have been about the Olympic Games, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. And I mean, it's interesting because they announced the draw for the, I think it's Nations League in the UK. Now, Ireland had come out and saying that Israel should be suspended from international football. And UEFA said no, they weren't going to do that. Now, Ireland have been drawn in the same group as Israel. So they've actually come out with a press release overnight from when we're recording this saying that they will not forfeit their game because they lose points. And then there are also ramifications if they do beyond that. I was thinking about it actually before we came on air today. And I'm wondering whether, and it will never happen because as we know, sporting bodies, the one thing they lack is testicular fortitude. And so I would like to see them though. If your country's at war, if you're involved in a war, you're not allowed to participate in our World Cup.
Yeah.
Both of them. I don't care. And you just, and it might make people, it might make the people stand up and say, hey, look, you know, look, we don't want this.
It might do. Although, you know, how do you define a war? Remember, well, what's happening in Ukraine isn't, according to one side, isn't technically a war. It's a special operation or some stupid way of talking their way around the word war.
No, look, I think what I was saying there is not a feasible solution, no. But it was just something that was making me think, you know, that something has to happen because it's sort of just, I don't know, it just doesn't seem to be going in the right direction and it just causes so much disruption.
Well, sport loves to tell you how sport's really important because it brings nations together and it brings on peace and all these sorts of stuff that we hear. But does it really? I mean, when was the last time an international football game helped resolve a violent, warlike situation in any country?
Well, there was the African player that was Didier Drogba. He pleaded to the crowd and they stopped the war for the game.
Did they?
Yep.
Run that past me?
So there was going to be, I think it was a World Cup qualifier, and he begged them to behave and stop, and they did stop.
For enough time for the...
for the game and everything to go peacefully ahead.
And then went back to fighting.
I can't remember if they did or not, but yeah, it certainly had an impact, put it that way.
Oh, well, I was wrong.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Jacobi from Germany, playing for the Delhi Wave Riders. You're watching... Oh, no, you're hearing. Hi, I'm Nicholas Jacobi from Germany, playing for the Delhi Wave Riders. You're hearing Not the Footy Show.
Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're catching up with Benita Merciades from Fair Play Publishing, which is basically a publishing company that she set up, which was to promote sporting books, and whether they be history, biographies, or whatever, as long as they recorded, obviously, important parts of sporting history. So we may as well hear what Benita has to say. Benita Merciades, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you, Ashley. It's great to be here.
Well, the last time we spoke, we were talking about your book had just come out, which was obviously causing a few problems at the time, but Whatever It Takes, about Australia's bid for the FIFA World Cup. How did that go in the end, and did you cop a lot of flack with it?
It went very well. It was particularly well received overseas because it was much more than about the Australian bid. It was actually about the bidding environment in which FIFA conducted those bids for 2018-2022. So there was probably less interest in Australia because Australian football fans tend not to want to read about the bad stuff and more interest overseas. So there has been a lot of readership and it did go very well.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen changes in FIFA, but I think there's a lot of us that do follow the political side of FIFA.
I certainly don't feel they've been changes for the better. And I don't know what your thoughts are.
No, I think that's probably right. You know, and I mean, I said this very at the time, and even in 2016 before the book was published, that really they were just changing deck chairs on the Titanic in terms of how the organisation is governed and run. And Gianni Infantino as president has proven to be every bit as focused on he being re-elected as Sepp Blatter was. There's a couple of big differences. Gianni Infantino's, you know, 30, 40 years younger, so he's much more focused on the marketing and the PR and getting all the glossy stuff right so people can sort of say, don't look, you know, over here, this is what's happening. So there's that. And he has put a few policies in place that he can tick a box on, but they don't actually follow those policies necessarily. And the big difference too is I think Sepp Blatter did genuinely love football. I'm not convinced from anything I've seen that Infantino does. And then, of course, you've got Infantino and he seems to be, which is a bit common with Blatter as well, but it seems to be his love affair with sort of interesting world leaders who, you know, tend to be, well, somewhat of despots in their own country, and that's who he gravitates towards, and I'm sure that's the way he would he likes to run FIFA as well.
Yeah, no, I get pretty much the same impression. But the reason we're catching up with you today is after obviously bringing your book out, you've now gone into the publishing world yourself with Fair Play Publishing. How did that come about? Because that's quite a change of career for you, who'd been involved in sports administration for so many years.
Yeah, it came about, well, I guess it's sort of related to the story of being involved in sports administration and then not being involved. And so I was thinking, well, what's something that I can do? And I actually was in my study at home one day and was looking through my books, and I recalled a book I had picked up in a bookstore years ago, last century, literally, and the Encyclopedia of Australian Cricketers. And I thought, oh, it'd be really good to have an encyclopedia of Socceroos. And I immediately thought, well, there's only one man who could write that, and that's Andrew Howe. And I literally, this was in 2016, I set up the company, got the name, did all of the things that you need to do that. And then I went and visited Andrew in Adelaide and said, look, I've had this great idea. Can you write it? And that was the first book that I commissioned, was the Encyclopedia of Socceroos, which we published for the first time in May 2018.
Did he curse you? Because I'm considering that must have been a hell of a lot of work, because it's a fantastic book.
I don't know whether he curses me, and if he's listening to this, hello, Andrew, but it is a fantastic book. As for the work, he would say himself that he had been doing it for the previous then 25, almost 35 years, because he tells his backstory in the introduction to the encyclopedia, which is that he grew up in rugby league territory in Sydney. He went along, I think, as a 19-year-old, just quite randomly to a football match between Marconi and Leichhardt, and fell in love with the game. Then, being a student statistician, as he was at the time, tried to find out more information about it and realised that it didn't exist. So then and there, as a 19-year-old, he decided to start creating data sets about Australian football, both the NSL as it was at the time and the Socceroos and the women's teams. So he would say the work was there, he just had to put it all together. And that's no mean feat.
No, absolutely. I must admit, he's always my go-to man when I need to check something. But, I mean, yes. Then, of course, you convinced him to do one on the Matildas as well.
Yes, well, that's right. The next year was the Women's World Cup in 2019, and we did one in 2019 and then an updated one in 2023.
So after commissioning that, how did you then grow? Was your focus always going to be books on football?
Yeah, my focus principally was books on football, because as a long-term football fan and you know, having grown up in the game, I was very aware that there were very few books on football in Australia, yet it had been around since the 19th century, if not 19th century. And there was very few stories to tell. I had written one of the books many years before. I wrote Frank Farina's biography, My World is Round. And there were a few sort of odds and ends books like that, like Matthew Hall had written one, Ray Gatt had written one, but there was no sort of focus on football. So I very much wanted to specialise in sharing Australian football stories. So I sort of thought, well, what are some of the stories around, and talked to a few people. And then, you know, as happens, word gets around and people come to you as well.
Yeah, and I mean, how has it been received? I mean, it's one thing, as we all know, as you said, you've written books yourself. It's one thing writing it. It's then another thing getting them sold and people buying them. How's that gone? And I mean, have people been aware of Fair Play Publishing, and have they found it and managed to get copies off you online, or do they go to the bookshops?
Both. Look, that's the most difficult part, and I wish there was an answer to that, or a magic wand you could wave. And particularly as a small business, an independent small business, so we're not part of one of the big publishers that's got fairly good budgets for marketing and PR and that sort of thing. So you're fighting a couple of things. One, you know, there's this, I guess, natural disinterest from the broader media in football stories, or in soccer stories, as they would call it. You know, they even will say they're surprised when you say it's been around since the 1850s in this country. So there's that, plus, you know, lack of budget for the PR and marketing campaign. I mean, in a proper book campaign, you know, even just for an ordinary, and I'm not disrespectful to authors, but even just for an ordinary book, not sort of a big name author or a big seller, you're going to be putting $6,000 to $10,000 behind that in a budget. Now, in a small business, you can't do that. And then you've got the costs of production, which include the editor, the proofreader, the designer, the production process, the printer, the distributor. You know, there's not, by the time you take all the salami slices off that recommended retail price, plus the guaranteed royalty for the author, there's not much to reinvest in the business. So from that perspective, that is absolutely the most difficult part of it. Receiving manuscripts and saying yes to them and developing them further and getting it done, that's the fun part. And, you know, I'm really delighted every time we publish a book, and particularly, you know, your own on Ladies First, the story of the 1988 women's hockey team, Michelle Ford's Turning the Tide, which was a great autobiography and actually moved, it resulted in change for the 1980 Olympic team. They were finally recognised last year by the Australian government. And, you know, books such as the one on Noddy Alston by Philip Micholiff and Andy Bernal's autobiography, Riding Shotgun. I am really proud, I have to say, to have brought these stories into the world.
Yeah, I mean, that must be the satisfying thing when there are those stories that are sort of little golden nuggets, aren't they, that you don't really realise. Like, I've always believed everybody has a story to tell, but some people just don't know how to tell it. They need a little bit of help. And obviously you're giving those people that opportunity and that help to tell those stories. Are you finding that there is almost like a sort of underground niche market for football stories, that there is a hunger amongst a certain section of the footballing supporters that really crave this stuff?
Absolutely. I mean, we would have, and getting back to your earlier question, which I didn't quite finish the answer, I guess, in that we sell via our website, which is fairplaypublishing.com.au, and we go into bookstores. But, you know, as I keep saying to authors, we can't make a bookstore take your book. We provide them with the sales and marketing material 4 to 5 months ahead of time. They have their sales team go out, but if bookstores don't want to take it, they don't take it. However, there is a niche market, in very niche, I have to say, but there is a niche market, and we have had, you know, a couple of handfuls of clients who, or customers who have bought every single football book we've published, and you know, they are, you know, from a business perspective, they are our most loyal customers. There's not one book they're all men, I have to say. There's not one book these men have not purchased.
That's fantastic. But I think there are those of us that like the published word in a book rather than online. We do tend to sort of hoard those, or we do look out for books when they come out and know that they're the ones we want.
Yes, and, you know, for people who are listening to this, I must say that Ashley and I are conducting this discussion over Zoom, and I'm looking at Ashley and part of his collection of 1,300 books behind him, which is a story in itself. We should turn the table, and I can ask you questions about your collection, Ashley.
Oh, look, that would take a while. I think my wife is getting a bit worried because we're running out of space, but... but yeah, I mean, the thing that's funny is, I mean, I'm a bit obsessive. I know where each one is. So again, it's really good if I need to refer to it for my commentary work or you know, something else if I'm writing a story. So for me, it's really important.
Yes. Yeah, I can see that. And they're beautifully kept. And I just even looking at some of the things behind you, I can see that they're in different categories. So yep, that I really admire that.
Yeah, there's a whole section of Australian football.
Yeah, the top. I can see them. I can see some of ours as well, so that's good.
Yep, no, and we featured several of your authors on Not the Footy Show as well to try and help them, because personally I know how hard it is. Now, you did sort of go out and you very kindly published My Ladies First, as you mentioned. I mean, have you now broadened it to other sports as well? Have you felt that's something you wanted to do, or was it something you needed to do?
A bit of both, but also because prospective authors have come to me and said, "Are you interested?" And you know, particularly, I mean, hockey's a really good example. Is in that it's a sport that's played a lot by young people, and it's a very it's an Olympic sport. It's popular at the Olympics, but we don't hear enough about it. And you know, that example of your book, Ladies First, it's a fantastic story. I mean, if you're in a trivia competition and someone asked which was the first Australian women's team to win a gold medal, I bet most people would not know at the Olympics. Most people would not know the answer to that. So I think it was an important story to bring. But other sports that we've done one we published last year was called The Natural, which was the biography of Richard Thornett, who played water polo for Australia in the 1960 Olympics, was a wallaby and a kangaroo. So he clearly was very good at sport. But they came to me. We're publishing Gary Jack's autobiography in next month. And, you know, he's a rugby league legend. Michelle Ford, you know, 1980 Olympian, the only non-East German woman to win a gold medal in the pool in that Moscow Olympics. She had a fantastic story to tell. And, you know, this is where it's frankly some of the big publishers are a bit silly. They didn't want to tell the story because from their perspective, they look at Michelle Ford and think, oh, you're in your early 60s. You don't have social media. No, we're not interested. That's part of what the decision making is for them. I've gone into, I'd always started with some books, some fiction books. Our first fiction books were all football books by Texie Smith, all football themed. And we've published more football themed fiction since then. And, you know, in terms of what I want to achieve for Fair Play Publishing, it is about sharing Australian football stories. And I think a way of doing that and building the culture of the game is to tell the game stories, and that includes in fiction. So we've now had quite a few fiction writers. And then I have published a few books that are really, I guess, mostly memoirs that don't fall into sport at all, but about life. And they're for different reasons that I've published them. One, mostly because I think, you know, they haven't been able to get another publisher, and some people would think, oh, well, don't you feel is if you're just a last resort, and no, I don't, because I think there's always the right publisher for the right story. But also looking at the different reasons, for instance, we published a book last year called A Secret Grief, and it was written by a 97-year-old, and she's 98 this year, and it is her story of being a young girl and a teenager in the 1930s and 40s through the war. And, you know, I think that's an important bit of Australian history to look at life in Australia at that time. And then, you know, there's a bit in the book where she talks about how she wrote a letter to her older, her uncle who was fighting in Egypt or somewhere, and she's put a throwaway line. She was 12 years old, throwaway line, like saying there are soldiers lined up in Sydney. And the letters were all interspersed and read. And next thing you know, the police turned up at her school to arrest her.
Oh, my you gosh.
Know, those sorts of stories, as you said, everyone has a story to tell. And I think it's great to be able to share them. Having said that, you know, we've still got, for this year, we've got a strong lineup of football books to come, and I'm looking forward to them being out as well.
Look, fantastic, Nan. I mean, on top of that, just to keep yourself busy, you're running the Manly Writers Festival. You're a sucker for punishment, aren't you?
Yeah, and I'm thinking that this year because it's got a bit bigger than Ben-Hur. And look, that started because I started a football writers' festival in 2019, and I did that because I wanted to give the authors that I was publishing an opportunity to talk about their books. And we got to 2023 and we had a fantastic football writers' festival. We had people from all over the world come in, such as Philippe Auclair and Thomas Hitzelsberger and Tarek Panja. And I'm not name dropping them. They were there and they were there for 3 days and part of it. And I sat there thinking, how am I going to improve on this? And then I thought, well, what we should do is look at having a smaller regional literary festival and incorporating our books into it. And this was on a weekend. I got home on the Tuesday and looked at my local council's website to see when event grants were open and closed, and they were closing in 3 days. So I put in an application and thinking, you know, we'll just see what happens. I got a grant, and therefore I then had to do the first Manly Writers Festival, which was 2024, and our third one is March 19 to 22.
Look, it's fantastic. I mean, as somebody that loves books, loves the history of sport, loves the stories behind the players or the games, I think what you're doing is truly fantastic. And obviously I'm very grateful because you published my book. But Benita, it is a fantastic thing that you're doing, I think, for people like me. Are you getting a reward from it personally? Like, are you happy that you're doing this and that you are keeping these stories alive and giving them a platform?
I think that's the right question to ask, actually, Ashley. It's not, you certainly, as a business, it's bad business. But I do get a lot of pleasure out of publishing the books. And, you know, I'll be quite frank, my first objective is not to lose money on a book. And then we just see how we go. And look, getting back to your early question too, I mean, I've published recently a few fiction books with fairly well-known writers, and nationally, I don't mean in football, but elsewhere. And they are to help support what we do through the sports books, because they're not the big sellers, which is why other publishers don't necessarily want to touch them. But it what we do elsewhere helps support the rest of what we want to publish. And yeah, the short answer to that question is yes, I get I think it's great that, you know, when we're all not on this planet anymore, all of your books will be sitting in the National Library and your respective state libraries in the archives forevermore. And the Andrew Howes, the future Andrew Howes of this world, and the future Ashley Morrisons, and the future Peter Kunzes, and all of those people who, and Trevor Thompson, who put in a lot of research and work into their books, their work will be there, and it'll be there as a record. And I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's really important. So, Benita, thanks not only for joining us today, but thanks for what you're doing, because I think it's a really important part of Australia's sporting history.
That's a pleasure. Thank you, Ashley.
Hi, I'm Thomas the Hitman Hearn, and you are listening to Not the Foodie Show.
And that was Benita Mercedes, the owner and publisher of Fair Play Publishing. And I will put the list of the website again. It's fairplaypublishing.com.au if you want to get any of the sporting books. And I can we've featured some of the authors here on Not the Footy Show over the years. And as I say, they were very kind to publish my book, Ladies First, about the 1988 Olympic hockey team, the women winning the gold for the first time. And I think it's great that she's done this, and it's great that there's now a record of a lot of these stories that will be there for many years to come.
Oh, I look forward to catching up with some of those books, actually. She's had an interesting journey, hasn't it, Benita?
Yep.
I mean, she was very much the whipping girl there for a little while. She copped a lot, and
a lot more than I think some people know as well.
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, in the fullness of time, turns out she might have been right.
Oh, I don't think there was any doubt there, was there?
No. Something else there wasn't doubt about, Ashley, over the summer. The big sporting...
Isn't it time to wrap up the show?
The big sporting event that happened here in Australia, of course, the Ashes. Now look, I get it that it probably wasn't the best lead up to an Ashes series by Toyota, but they, yeah, I get why they, what?
Toyota? Why? What did they do?
Well, they were playing against Westpac, weren't they?
Okay. Yes. Sorry. I forgot that. Yes.
I'm sure that it had the name, their team name emblazoned across the front of there.
I don't like it on the jumpers.
On the shirts. I mean, who...
No, the jumpers, when they have it on the jumper as well. Oh, I don't like that.
I that one slipped me by, I'm glad.
Yep.
But, you know, you could... It would be very easy to bag the English about... Or Toyota.
Yep.
About their lead-up to... And I think some of that criticism is a bit harsh because we don't live in the age... that we used to live in. And now I don't know what these people wanted them to do, hop on a boat for 3 months and then do a six-week tour.
No, but they were very underprepared. Well, and I think...
And the underprepared came from the fact they were in New Zealand playing stupid T20 and one-day games and then coming over here and a week later trying to play Test cricket.
But, yeah, and all they had was a warm-up game against the England B or whatever they call now, the Young Lions. So, who had no experience of playing in Australia. So, and I was looking at Brendan McCullum's record. He didn't play many Test matches in Australia either.
No.
And so you're going, you've got a coach.
Did you win any?
Yeah, you've got a coach with very little experience of playing in this country in a Test match. And you had a captain with, Joe Root had the most experience but hadn't done well. It was foolhardy, and everyone was telling them it was foolhardy, and then for Ben Stokes to call those who were saying this is madness has-beens, I mean, it was just a disaster, a PR disaster from day one.
It was, and look, it's not to say that they're, I think everybody was underwhelmed by the end of the, you know, because Australia won so easily.
But I think what galled me was here we were supposed to, as fans, and yes, I still support England, that they had done 6 months preparation for this. Where was the proof of that? They did not look like they'd done any homework. And I think the thing that frustrated me was not the batting. You sort of think, yeah, that was rash. It was foolish, but the bowling was terrible. Like, I don't think I've been, and I've lived in Australia now for 40 years. So I've seen a lot of Ashes tours over here. This was the most embarrassing, the most humiliating, and I thought the lack of the lack of application by the players. Like, the bowlers coming into bowl didn't even get the ball on the spot the first over. I mean, that's unforgivable. The Australian bowlers did, came running in, bang, on the spot. But the English bowlers, I mean, I thought Archer was a waste of time.
He had about 3 minutes in the three tests that he played that was worth bowling him. And in Queensland, that one innings where he rattled Smithy.
Yeah.
Or Smithy rattled him. But he was bowling with a bit of pace and venom, and he was looking like, oh, yeah, this is the job we know. But it only lasted, you know, a split second.
I mean, it was, yeah.
And look.
But I mean, then you look at, again, who's assisting with the bowling coaching for England. I mean, you had Jimmy Anderson, a guy who four tours took 5 wickets once. His record in Australia was terrible, and he was assisting to prepare them. And you're like, but you didn't even succeed here. Get a bowler who actually succeeded in Australia.
Yeah, I think you got to take your hat off to Mitchell Starc.
Oh, he was superb.
Absolutely. And especially for a guy who very early on in his career was known as a bloke that could take wickets, but also known as a guy that would leak serious runs at times. His bowling was phenomenal. Yes, he still bowls those balls that get hit, but he was setting batsmen up like just, it was kindergarten stuff, some of what he was doing.
Well, you looked at how he was enjoying it, and I think he realised, I'm probably never going to have a series like this because everything I do is working.
Yeah, he was good. I mean, you saw a guy like Travis Head take the game away from England in the first test. Alex Carey's wicket keeping at times was absolutely sensational. Him standing up to the stumps when a bloke's bowling reasonably fast, Even if you're standing up to the stumps to a spinner, they're still coming down 80, 90 kilometres an hour. It's not a comfortable place to be.
But also his batting. I mean, he batted superbly as well. I just thought he was so consistent in everything he did throughout the series.
Yeah. And when you look at England, I mean, Cam Green, you could argue, failed. I think the opening spot, Aussie, he was probably never going to really succeed. And then he hurt his back, so that was basically the end of that.
It was just
it was a great opportunity for England to really put pressure on Australia, because there was a lot of guys that weren't necessarily playing well. Steve Smith played all right. He had a couple of really
Labuschagne
good
innings. Or Labuschagne, as they call him.
He was average.
Very,
But you look at England and you go, well, who stuck out?
Ben Stokes was the captain batted his heart out and bowled his heart out.
Oh, no doubt. And that's why he broke down in the end. Yeah. Because he was having to
carry the team.
Yeah. Joe Root came good, but not good enough soon enough. Because it's those first two tests that are the important ones. It's not often a team comes back from 2-0 down in a 5-test series to win them.
Very rare.
Yeah.
Very rare.
You've got to get wins on the board early. I mean, we heard all about Wood and Archer. They were just banging on about how good their bowlers were. Well, Wood lasted how long? And everybody before the series started was saying, the guy's not going to make it. He's not fit. He hasn't played enough cricket. And guess what? He broke down.
Yep.
And then to not pick their specialist. Why bring a bloody specialist spinner to Australia and then not pick him on the wickets he's most likely to get wickets on? That was just dumb. Because the guy they did pick to bowl spin was really average. And the Australians loved facing him. They had no hesitations or worries about that guy.
John, I just got over the pain of all this and you're just making it all come back. I'm sitting here so depressed again now. Because it was dreadful.
Huh.
That's the only word I can use. It was appalling cricket by England.
Yeah, it was. Are you following any of the T20 World Cup?
I don't watch it.
You don't. It's
irrelevant. I mean, and here was the thing. There was, I forget which, one of the Australian players just announced his retirement from ODIs and T20 recently. Uh-huh. And I couldn't believe because I saw the headline, you know, the clickbait, Legend of Australian Cricket Retires. And it's like, the guy didn't even play Test cricket. He played something like 70 T20 games and about 18 ODIs. And you go, that is not a legend of the game. I'm sorry. If you're making legends in T20, the game is in a really bad place.
Well, it's funny because in Australia at the moment, I don't think there's much
interest in the T20 at World Cup.
Well, partly because it's on Prime. And it's not on free-to-air. It's not even on KO or something like that. It's on Prime. So a lot of people don't have access to it. And there's a bit of radio coverage, but the ABC is not covering it, for example. It's on SEN.
But this is, again, one of the problems we've got with a lot of sports is they've vanished from the airwaves. You've got to go and find out who's broadcasting it, what time it's on, where it's on, and so many people I know who are sports lovers are just going, I've just given up. It's all too hard.
Well, I also wonder how many people might have been like me. I said, because I noticed it wasn't on KO. Well, where do I watch it? Oh, it's on Prime. So, you know, I got one of those widgety things here on your television and you can pick Prime and you can sign up and it's like, oh, okay. So I clicked on it and I'm looking at it about to start up the sign up process and then I went, Prime, Amazon Prime. Jeff Bezos, Amazon Prime. And just went, no, he's not getting my money. And I wonder if there are a lot of people like me who just thought, you know, he doesn't need my money. I can live without watching the T20 World Cup. I can follow it on the paper or on the internet, get the scores if I want to.
And that's the sad thing though, but I think that's happening with a lot of sports now today.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wonder how much it's affecting participation at junior levels. Because, you know, when you're growing up, you know, like I in England, my it was school holidays, the cricket was on. My mum would give me my chores to do in the morning and I would race around to get them done so that at 11 o'clock when the test match started, I was in front of the TV and I'd got everything done so I could watch it. But today, you just sort of think, well, they don't have that urgency now. They, as you said, they can watch the highlights. Do they have the heroes that we had, that we looked up to, and then after the day's play, you'd go running outside and you were going to be that player? You know, I don't know. I don't hear children in the park opposite me where I live saying that they want to be, you know, Travis Head, or they want to be Steve Smith, or they want to be Mitchell Starc when they're playing cricket. I just don't hear that today.
Do you like fish and chips, Ashley?
Yes.
Yeah. So every now and then you'll get yourself some fish and chips and you go, that was really good. I like fish and chips.
Correct.
What if you had to eat fish and chips every day? How would you feel about fish and chips after about 3 weeks of eating it every day?
I'd feel very greasy on the inside.
But the same thing applies yep. to sport and stuff. When we were growing up, how often would you see your test players play? We'd have 6 tests over the summer.
We had 5 in England. You never had more. Well, occasionally you had 2-3 sets of 3, yeah.
5 or 6 we used to get. And then the Australian team would be somewhere else in winter. And they'd play another 5 tests or 6 tests. So you're talking 12 opportunities max to see these guys in action. So when you got that opportunity, it meant something.
Yeah. Oh, look, I agree with you. And I think that's the other thing. I think there is too much sport. I wrote a piece on my blog saying, is there too much sport? And I think what we're also seeing is because there's too much sport, the cost of putting it on various platforms or television or whatever is a cost. So we're seeing the standard of the broadcast has actually gone down, I would say, with the second tier sports. I still think if you look at your cricket, your football, NRL. Your NRL, you know, the quality there is still there. But the second tier sports, some of them now are really poorly produced and poorly televised.
And I think sport gets conned by a lot of these people because they're only after content. They just want something on their screen and they don't really care that much if it's any good. They just want content.
Yep.
And so, you know, sports are being sold this lie, I guess, that they're going to get X, Y, and Z and all this is going to happen for them, but it doesn't. Never works out that way.
No. And the problem you've got as well is when you give your content to a broadcaster and they're not paying for it, they don't have to air it if they don't want to.
No.
And so they can either run it late, they can not run it when the game's going on, they can put something else on instead. And so then you really are at the bottom of the pile.
And, you know, it wouldn't be a Not the Footy Show without having a slight dig at Hockey Australia. 5:30 on a Tuesday night is a dumb time to play an international game of any description, be it Pro League or whatever, I don't care. 5:30 on a Tuesday night. It makes no sense at all.
And especially when a lot of the club sides have just gone back to training at that time.
Well, I'm not sure that affects the crowd so much, but...
No, but it would affect viewers.
It would, yeah, it would affect viewers.
But then how many people watch the Pro League?
I don't know. You'd be throwing a very, very wide net over a large crowd to get one, I would think.
Yeah, I think you would... And all I can say, and hopefully someone from the FIH is listening, because I, in India, spoke to a lot of the players and a lot of the coaching staff and also a lot of fans. And I can honestly say not one person that spoke to me said that the Pro League should continue. They also get rid of it. We hate it. It is not achieving anything. It is just basically costing a fortune. And they said, we just need to finish it and accept that it was a bad mistake.
Oh, it's a great big hole they're throwing money into. That's all that's happening. Yep. Wasting money.
And it was interesting because somebody was telling me that we, Australia, were meant to pull out and had made an agreement when New Zealand announced they were pulling out.
Yes.
But then we reneged, apparently. Now there's a little bit of tension between us and our friends on across the Tasman Sea.
Oh, I hope that plays out in the next Oceania Cup.
Oh, well, hopefully it will. A little bit of niggle.
Yeah.
I love a bit of niggle.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is foul.
See ya. We'll be back next week.